Welcome to Poetry Lectures, a series of lectures by poets, scholars, and educators, presented by PoetryFoundation.org. For this program, we dip into the archives to hear one of the giants of 20th century American poetry.
Anytime any analyst of a poem is too confident about what the poem means, why, either walk out on him or challenge him.
Carl Sandburg. In the time since March 1914, when Harriet Monroe published his first poems in her new magazine, Poetry, Carl Sandburg had become one of the best-known American poets in the world. This recording comes from 1956, when Sandburg was at the peak of his fame. He had already won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, published his monumental biographies of Lincoln, corresponded with Presidents Roosevelt and Truman, and tirelessly crossed the country giving readings and lectures to large audiences. In this program, we'll hear Sandburg give a relaxed and wide-ranging talk, offering frank opinions that address many of his lifelong concerns. He reads 2 poems, For You and Psalm of the Blood Bank, which describes his vision of humanity as one great family. He finishes by performing a few songs. The program was part of a Sandburg celebration, sponsored by Poetry Magazine. Here's Carl Sandburg speaking at the Schubert Theater in Chicago on November 18th, 1956.
Now, you are very kind, and I know I've got friends out there in the dark. But I can't see a face. I've made the request that you should be lighted up. That's very different from being lit up. There are some faces that I love out there, and I'd rather see them than have them shrouded in darkness. Give them all that you can, Mr. Electrician, and then I'll do the best that I can. It's one of the elder statesmen of Britain who has said that we have seen a half century of the most terrible events that ever ravaged the human race. And very strangely, in those same 50 years, there have been more discoveries, more new discoveries having to do with transport and communication and the comfort and convenience of mankind. More discoveries and inventions than in the preceding 5,000 years. Yet war has gone on. Brutalities on a wide scale, almost inexplicable, almost beyond explanation. We're riding now in a crisis whose end no one can foretell. There have come culturally new media. There have come across the last 50 years the movies, the flickers, the silver screen, Hollywood. And radio and television. And all of these are cultural instruments beyond reckoning. There are people who use them without any consideration of what is happening to them because they use them. I met a college boy a while ago who said that he had to have 3 movies a week. And I said, you pathetic sap, you. 1 a month is enough. They don't make 12 good ones out there a year. And I meet a year or two ago a college boy that said that for 4 years, he had never failed to hear a Jack Benny program. Comes Sunday night, and he doesn't know he's an addict. He's got to have his dope. and TV. Of course, there are priceless things come on TV, radio, occasionally in the movies. But there are those who, in connection with radio and TV, they just sit there and take it. Human sponges. Whatever comes, they absorb it, just like the creators of it figured. Appealing to the subconscious, appealing to blood rather than brain. And in the colleges and universities, I hope they will have courses about training for the use of these three media as compared with the book. The books stand in rows on a shelf, and you can pick out what you want. You go as far as you please in the book. Where it gets stupid, you can skip it. Where it's very fine and priceless and you want it over again, you can have it as many times over again as you like. And I go back to Leonardo da Vinci and Mr. William Shakespeare and Mr. John Milton way back. And farther along, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln. They knew nothing of any of these media. The book was the one main medium of culture, along with intercourse with fellows who were also interested. None of these bright, unforgettable names with all their associations culturally, none of them ever saw a movie or heard a radio or TV cast. About so much a week is enough. About 15 to 20% of what comes along on television. Radio, I haven't got the percentage figured. So much time is occupied, well, in both the media, with buffering, Carter's little liver pills. And God help us, what products. I watched the World Series and I got an impression that there are just millions of men rushing around the United States wondering what the hell to shave with. No, there is such a thing. These men that I named, and it can be a string of geniuses back thousands of years. To Li Po, the Chinese poet, to David, who wrote the Psalms, to whoever the poet was that wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. They all knew such a thing as creative solitude. Loneliness, they knew how to use loneliness. They were not afraid of loneliness. With being alone, with their solitude came their creative works. And that composer and violinist Paganini, when he was asked what was the secret of the fine and the great work that he did, he had three words, just three words. Toil, solitude, prayer. Toil, solitude, and prayer. No movies, no radio, no TV, the poor fish. And I will have to refer here today to the case of modern poetry with relation to what this country stands for. I don't say the poets should be writing about what this country stands for, what it has fought for, what, oh, a lot of fine boys and men have died for. It goes way back to these 3 points that President Masaryk of the newly organized Czechoslovak Republic in 1920, what he said to my friend Fraser Hunt of the Chicago Tribune, "You of the American nation, you have 3 advantages that most of the countries of Europe don't have at all. You have no state church with all the authorities and all the difficulties that go with such an establishment. And you have no military caste, no class of professional military men on the order of the German Junkers. Of course, we are dangerously close to having it with what the Pentagon does and says today, but many are aware of it, and the danger is not immediate, but the Pentagon has to be watched. For the way it mingles in political affairs and in business affairs. I was at West Point in the month of June in 1899 when Douglas MacArthur was there. You might say we were classmates almost, though I stayed only 2 weeks and he stayed 4 years. I was found deficient in arithmetic and grammar. I had forgotten all that I knew about square root and cube root. And I had forgotten a definition that I had memorized, a grammarian's definition of a verb. Well, at that time and now, I know a verb a mile off coming toward me. But anyhow, Douglas MacArthur, his whole life has been occupied with military affairs, and now he has a $100,000 a year job at the head of Remington Rand. Well, I don't say there ought to be any action, but I think it says something for the ego of General MacArthur that he likes to be ranked as an industrialist when he's a military man. And then a third of these points, with a reference to America and the disadvantages it does not have that they have in most of their European countries. At that time, a titled upper class, a nobility, generally having large property holdings. The American Revolution said there should be an end to them for all time. And in connection with modern poetry of the present hour, I think of a diary entry of Ralph Waldo Emerson early in the month of March in 1838. It was one of the shortest entries he ever made in his journal. It was not a complete sentence, even. He wrote, "Bad, bad to see a row of children looking old. Bad to see a row of children looking old." And I'm not going to go into an analysis of that, though I could take an antithesis of it. A woman that I saw one time in a Michigan Central train crossing Michigan, with a 6-year-old boy. She had him standing at the window looking out. And nearly every moment he was seeing something new. And he was calling out to his mother about it, calling out in such a way that the man in the seat in front was bothered. After a while, he couldn't sleep or rest or have his thoughts to himself. He turned around and gave the both of them a dirty look. And the woman caught it. And she said to the man, "Oh, you must excuse him. He thinks everything is wonderful." And in that cult known, for instance, as the New Criticism, one of the several movements in American poetry of today, the New Criticism, it comes wrapped in cellophane and has not known the touch of human hands. A mortal fear of being naive, whereas nearly all of the great poems have a quality of naivete. And in all that I have to say about the poets who write for a coterie, write for a clique, and who write about each other, about how good they are and how they understand each other, I'm thinking of the Irish poet William Butler Yeats, over at a dinner that Harriet Monroe gave for the Poetry Magazine and a group of friends up at the Cliff Dwellers Club, along about 1915, perhaps. And William Butler Yeats quoted his father, the painter, John Butler Yeats, as saying, "What can be explained is not poetry. What can be explained is not poetry." Anytime any analyst of a poem is too confident about what the poem means, why, either walk out on him or challenge him. I remember one of George Ade's fables in slang. It dealt with the vogue of the vague. It can be carried too far. His fable was about a preacher who found that he was just too simple, too clearly expository in his sermons, and he decided he would become a little mysterious, and he filled his church. He understood the vogue of the vague. The boy that came home from college bringing a fraternity brother, introducing his fraternity brother to his grandmother, who was very deaf. He said, "Mother, grandma, this is Mr. Speck Noodle." Very loud. And she shook her head. And he gave it again at the top of his voice, "Mr. Speck Noodle." And she shook her head with a wearisome smile and said, "No, I guess it's no use. It sounds to me like Speck Noodle." I have some jottings here from an old notebook that might interest you and that are proper for this occasion. Vachel Lindsay, an Illinois poet who wrote some verse that's going to last a long time. Two lyrics, "Abraham Lincoln Walks at Midnight" and "Eagle Forgotten." Poem to John Peter Altgeld. "The man who pardoned the anarchists back there in 1893, they had been convicted in 1886 and four of them hanged. in the Cook County Jail nearby. And he was excoriated, and he had killed himself politically. Ran for mayor of Chicago and was defeated in the Unity Building that was his own privately owned skyscraper, was lost through a variety of shameful operations, and he died early with a broken heart while speaking down at Joliet in behalf of the embattled Boers wanting a republic and self-determination in South Africa. Eagle forgotten. I sat with Rachel one day on the green grass of Grant Park one summer afternoon, and he made the innocent remark to me, "Carl, American art has always got to have the quality of flamboyance." And his own work had it. He also remarked to me one time, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to try to be a poet and at the same time not a jackass." And the Chinese proverb, how it will go for this hour, "Everything in the past died yesterday. Everything in the future was born today." I started working on that years ago, and I'm still working on it. And a reporter going to the studio of Brancusi, the Romanian sculptor resident in Paris the last 50 years, seeing Brancusi's studio workshop, he noted that there was in it not a trace of the icy tidiness peculiar to cerebral artists. Not a trace of the icy tidiness peculiar to cerebral artists. How that will go for 5 or 6 poets that I could name, but there'd be no cause served whatsoever by naming them. I forget who was the old Ohio professor who said, when I met him some years back, "You can no more teach what you don't know than you can come back from a place you didn't go to." You can no more teach what you don't know than you can come back from a place you didn't go to. And away back, some 40 years ago, Jean Jaurès, the great French orator and very moderate socialist, "When the literary class betray a destitution of faith, it is not strange that society should be disheartened and sensualized by unbelief." That should be tied right in with Scott Fitzgerald saying along about 1934-35, "We are tired of great causes. We are tired of great causes." Anytime that happens to American literature in the main, the American Republic is in a bad way. And then I'll close from this notebook with Bill Nye. Of course, he pronounced it Wagner. He wouldn't say Wagner. He'd consider himself discredited. He said, "I'm told that Wagner's music is better than it sounds. I'm told that Wagner's music is better than it sounds. I remember when Harriet Monroe, quoting from a New York magazine editor, saying to her, "The poetry we print is for the barber's wife in a small town in the Middle West. The poetry we print is for the barber's wife in a small town in the Midwest." Well, she told that to her, those associates of hers, Alice Corbin, assistant editor, Edith Franklin Wyatt, Frances Shaw, the wife of an architect, who wrote a little book, A Baby's Day. And you might think it almost impossible that a small volume of verse could be done that makes you think of the pleasures and troubles of a baby. And Wallace Stevens used to come in once in a while. I went to lunch with him and Harriet Monroe once, and he said that he was asked one time, what is the main quality of a good poem? And he said, the main quality of it is that it's inevitable. Well, what do you mean, inevitable? Well, the writer of it couldn't help writing. It's like the boy that sneezed in church, and after the services, his mother rebuked him, and the boy said, I didn't sneeze. The sneeze sneezed me. And that will go for nearly all poems of any value. Anything like Walter Delamere's Listeners that I read 52 years ago, clipped it from an editorial page of the Milwaukee Sentinel, and I'm still carrying it around and read it once or so a year. The Listeners. One of those poems that's drenched with mystery, and yet it has music, and yet you feel too that it has meaning that's somewhat beyond words. And I've never written a credo of my own for the writing of poetry, but I could give a dedication that I wrote for my book Home Front Memo during the war, 1943, dedicating it to the life, works, and memory of Stephen Vincent Benet, an American poet, along with Archie MacLeish, a Chicago boy, North Shore boy, and three or four others that I could name. Stephen Vincent Benet, who knew the distinction between pure art and propaganda in the written or spoken word. He could sing to give men music, consolation, pleasure. He could intone chant or prayer, pointing the need for men to act. He illustrated the code and creed of those writers who seek to widen the areas of freedom for all men, knowing that men of ideas vanish first when freedom vanishes. He saw that a writer's silence on living issues can in itself constitute a propaganda of conduct leading toward the deterioration or death of freedom. He wrote often hoping that men would act because of his words. He could have been Olympian, whimsical, seeking to be timeless amid bells of doom, not to be put off. I remember meeting Thomas Mann in Washington, along there about 1943. I reminded him that I had seen a magazine article of his in which he said that the German intellectuals were wrong across the 1920s in living by themselves too much, having their private lingo, having their own vocabularies as between themselves, a high-up gobbledygook. What do they care about the plain people or the children of Germany, the youth? They didn't know. They didn't know that Adolf, the little demon, had a technique of his own, with an awful simplicity about it, aimed at getting the young in under his banner. And this German novelist, Nobel Prize winner, he admitted, yes, we should have had a little of the technique of Hitler. The literary class in Germany was partly responsible for the rise of the Nazis because they were so indifferent to the children and the youth. Perhaps I could read here today a few numbers from this book titled Complete Poems. Perhaps I could find the last poem in the book, Smoke and Steel. Perhaps that would serve as a benediction to the services, to the sermon. Music is to follow. Titled For You. The peace of great doors be for you. Wait at the knobs, at the panel oblongs, wait for the great hinges. The peace of great churches be for you, where the players of loft pipe organs practice old lovely fragments. Hello. The peace of great books be for you, stains of pressed clover leaves on pages, bleach of the light of years held in leather. The peace of great prairies be for you. Listen among wind players in cornfields, the wind learning over its oldest music. The peace of great seas be for you. Wait on a hook of land, a rock footing for you, wait in the salt wash. The peace of great mountains be for you, the sleep and the eyesight of eagles, sheet mist shadows and the long look across. The peace of great hearts be for you, valves of the blood of the sun, pumps of the strongest wants we cry. The peace of great silhouettes be for you. Shadow dancers alive in your blood now, alive and crying, let us out, let us out. The peace of great changes be for you. Whisper, O beginners in the hills, tumble, O cubs, tomorrow belongs to you. Peace of great loves be for you. Rain soak these roots, wind shatter the dry rot. Bars of sunlight, grips of the earth, hug these. The peace of great ghosts be for you. Phantoms of night gray eyes ready to go to the fog star dumps to the fire white doors. Yes. The peace of great phantoms be for you. Phantom iron men, mothers of bronze, keepers of the lean, clean breed. I thought I had along with me. This will do very well for the closing piece. This was in Collier's of last year, titled Psalm of the Blood Bank, quoting from the Acts, 1726. And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth. Scarlet the sunset, crimson the dawn, rising moon gold red curves through the night to sinking moon gold red. Poppy red a singing woman's lips, ruddy red the blush of true love's rose, fleeting the flash of a bird wing red. Red the cardinal's hat, red the communist flag. Token red the corpsman's right sleeve cross. Red the emblem cross of surgeon, nurse, ambulance, of hospital tent and ship. Crimson bloodstreams poured together and together, blended into one likeness, mingled in mute communions, Catholic in flow with Protestant, Nordic in flux with Negro, scoffers, sinners, deniers, in strength and rest from blood of Christian believers. Help and quiet to Christian believers from blood of thieves, harlots, blasphemers. Deep, oh deep, brother. Deep, oh deep, sister. The scarlet and crimson, the human blood bank, red.
That was Carl Sandburg speaking in 1956. As he often did, Sandburg ended the program with some songs. In fact, he began playing guitar and singing years before he had published any poetry. Throughout his early career, Sandburg collected and notated folk songs. In 1927, he published American Song Bag, a collection of 255 songs, which he called an all-American affair, the genius of thousands of original singing Americans. Few recordings are available of Carl Sandburg singing, so it's a special treat to hear him finish this program with a medley of songs, accompanying himself on guitar.
Back summer rainy day, old Smoky Joe, Lordy, died on the road saying, I'll be back someday. Cold rainy day, some old cold rainy day, I'll be back some old cold rainy day. All I want is my railroad fare, take me back where I was born. Oh, the rock may be my pillow, Lord, the sand may be my bed. I'll be back summer rainy day, cold rainy day, summer cold rainy day. I'll be back summer. summer rainy day. Oh, they took John Henry to the steep hillside. He looked to the heaven above. He says, take my hammer and wrap it in gold and give it to the girl I love. And give it to the girl I love. If I die a railroad man, go bury me under the tie so I can hear old number four when she goes a-rolling by. When she goes a-rolling by. If I die a railroad man, go bury me under the sand. Put a pick and a shovel at my head and my feet, and a 9-pound hammer in my hand. A 9-pound hammer in. Look down, look down that lonesome road. Hang down your head and cry. The best of friends must part someday, and why not you and I? And why not you and I? I wish to God that I had died before I was born, before I seen your smiling face and heard your lying tongue and heard your lying tongue. Young, come over, tell me, how do you know I'd call her a apron and a dress she wore? Umbrella on her shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. She says to the captain, I want my man. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. 20 long years in penitentiary. It was one October morning that I seen a wondrous sight. Was a timber rover, Bigelow, a-hailin' from Detroit. Watch her, catch her, jump up in her jujubatoo, give her the sheet and let her go with the boys to see her through. You should have heard her howlin' when the wind was blowin' free. 'Twas on the trip to Buffalo from a mill walkie. Oh, way down upon the Wabash, such land was never known. If Adam had passed over it, the soil he'd surely own. He'd think it was the garden he played in when a boy, and straight pronounced it Eden in the state of Illinois. Then move your family westward, bring all your girls and boys, and cross at Shawnee Ferry to the state of Illinois. 'Twas here the Queen of Sheba came with Solomon of old, with an ass load of spices, pomegranates, and fine gold. And when she saw this lovely land, her heart was filled with joy. Straightway she said, I'd like to be a queen in Illinois. Then move your family westward, bring all your girls and boys, and cross that Shawnee Ferry to the state of Illinois. Trouble don't last always. Oh my Lord, what I do. Make room, Lord, in my heart for thee. Oh my Lord, you ride that horse, you call him Macedoni. Jesus, won't you come by? You ride him in the morning and you ride him in the evening. Jesus, won't you come by? The Lord knows the world going to end up. Jesus, won't you come by? Days about 12 o'clock, this old world gwine reel and rock. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you moan. Mary wore three links of chain. Mary wore three links of chain. Mary wore three links of chain, every link bearing Jesus' name. All my sins been taken away, taken away. I don't know what I've been told. I don't know what I've been told. I don't know what I've been told. The streets of heaven are paved with gold. All my sins been taken away, taken away. Ain't been to heaven, but I've been told. Ain't been to heaven, but I've been told they're waiting for me, waiting for me. Ain't been to heaven, but I've been told go and play for my father on a harp of gold. Way over in the heavenly land, they're waiting for me.
That was Carl Sandburg at the Schubert Theater in Chicago on November 18, 1956. The program was sponsored by Poetry Magazine as part of a Carl Sandburg celebration. You can read a biography of Carl Sandburg, as well as a wide selection of his poetry, at poetryfoundation.org. You'll also find many other articles about poetry, an online archive of more than 8,000 poems, and other audio programs to download. I'm Ed Herman. Thanks for listening to Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.